You're listening to Radio Primavera Sound, proudly presented by Cupra.
Welcome back.
Hello.
We are here with Joel Marhol, who is the author of the new book, Rebel Sounds, Music as Resistance, which came out last Thursday. Congratulations. How are you doing?
Yeah, good. It's been fun. Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Sorry, I kind of mangled your last name then. I'm not sure. I think it was a frog in my throat.
Pretty close. That was pretty close.
But I wanted to start. So you're a researcher and historian of post-war and contemporary fascism. Why did you decide to focus on that area?
So all the previous books, I work for an anti-fascist organisation in the UK called Hope Not Hate, and all of my previous books have been, as you say, on fascism. And obviously they're understandably pretty depressing topics, looking at the bad guys constantly, if you will. And I wanted to do something a bit more hopeful. I wanted to do something a bit more like looking at some of the things that have worked in fighting back. And obviously, you know, there's a lot written on campaigns and elections and all those sorts of things. But like music had always been my big passion and had been a big part of the way we worked at Hope Not Hate. And so I wanted to look back and find stories about musicians and artists that had fought racism and oppression and dictatorships and see what we could learn from those people for a lot of the things that are happening right now as well.
Well, I was going to say, because I've only read the intro and some of the first chapter, I've really enjoyed it. But what I've seen is it is quite uplifting. I mean, the intro where you go to Kyiv and you speak to the orchestra there and they talk about their kind of reasons for wanting to play, you know, even in very difficult circumstances, I found quite uplifting. Did you have to sort of look for something uplifting, or was it more that is kind of what comes out?
I thought I was going to have to hunt around. You know, when you say you're writing a book that's about, you know, the apartheid era of South Africa or civil rights in America or war in Ukraine or dictatorships in Nigeria and Brazil, I thought it was going to be pretty depressing. You'd have to hunt out stories. But actually, everywhere I went, it was the most uplifting thing I'd ever done, really. I met the most inspirational people. And you know, I mean, I love music, but I just kept coming across people that loved music to a point where they were, you know, they were risking imprisonment or even death in some cases just to play music or to listen to a record. Or you know, they knew that if they got found out listening to a record in the back room of some bombed out building, they could be arrested for that. And I found the whole thing pretty inspirational, really. And also, I just didn't realize how broad resistance music is. You know, I think I probably started the book thinking, you know, as you do, someone with acoustic guitar singing political songs. And I realized how much broader it is than that. How much, you know, sometimes it is someone listening to electronic music in a bomb shelter in Ukraine, or sometimes it's listening to kind of pop music. But there's all these different forms of resistance music, which I didn't really know about until I started the book years ago.
Well, I find it very interesting that in the intro to the book, you actually say, you know, for people who talk about hip hop or punk, you know, I'm sorry, I haven't covered that. But there's just so much. I mean, did you think about kind of covering those two areas? Or I'm not saying they're missing, but I mean, they're just kind of, as you mentioned, they do often kind of come up when people talk about music as resistance.
Yeah, I mean, what I wanted the book to be was like a kind of a broad cross section of different stories and hidden histories, if you will, that show all the different types of resistance music that could be out there. And there's, as you say, there's a lot written on hip hop. And I do kind of touch on early hip hop in the American chapter. And you know, there's a lot written on Bob Marley and you know, and those sorts of figures. But in some ways, that's the sort of resistance movement people think of. You know, I wanted to kind of find what else has been out there. How else have people resisted? You know, what was the role of Bossa Nova against the military dictatorship in Brazil? You know, Fela Kuti in Nigeria, or even like people smuggling records behind the Iron Curtain. I wanted to find stories that essentially showed all the different types of resistance music over the last 100 years, but trying to find stories that maybe a bit different or weren't quite as obvious. The sort of things that, there's nothing wrong with it, by the way, I love all that music as well, but the sort of things that you'd maybe know about from big Netflix series and those sorts of things. I wanted to go elsewhere and see if I could find the smaller little stories that told different and new and exciting ways to get into it.
What was it like being in Kyiv in 2023? Basically, you're around about the first year anniversary of the invasion. And you talk about, you know, going, you know, having to go into a bomb shelter. And it just sounds fascinating. What was it like?
I mean, it was an odd one in one sense, right? When you're in, you know, when you're in Ukraine, it was the first anniversary of the war, so there was lots of air raids going on. Obviously, by this point, Kyiv had they'd pushed back the Russian tanks, so the imminent invasion of Kyiv wasn't quite as immediate. But it, so in some ways, it felt like a relatively normal city. There's people in cafes and bars and restaurants.
Wow.
But then you turn the corner and you could see all the scars of this war, you know, whole skyscrapers just missing, you know, sides of the buildings, you know, smashed windows, tanks on the side of the road that were bombed out. So you could see all of those scars that sat there. But what really surprised me was how remarkably vibrant the cultural scene still was. You know, I spent a lot of time with DJs that were putting on raves in bomb shelters, or, and, you know, there was a curfew, you know, at the time. So they would do day raves. But it was about how it was changing their music, which was most interesting. You know, all of these people I was speaking to, they basically wanted to play Berghain in Berlin. You know, they wanted to be techno DJs traditionally. But now they'd started to realize that actually, how could they use the music for the war? And so they were going out and finding like traditional Ukrainian instruments and traditional Ukrainian folklore and fusing that into their electronic music to turn around and kind of prove essentially that they did have a distinct Ukrainian culture at a time when Russia was saying that they didn't. It was the only place in the whole book I went where they said music's about building up walls, whereas everyone else said, you know, obviously music's about breaking down walls. For them, it was about saying, no, we have a, you know, unique, you know, historical identity. So it was pretty inspiring, really. You know, like, as I say, like, I think I love music, but for them, music was now this way that they were raising money to arm their friends and to like protect themselves. They were raising money and they were putting on raves in positions, you know, of unimaginable danger. You know, you'd be sat there in the bars and your phone's going off, flashing, and it says air raids and everyone's running down into bomb shelters. You know, it was a pretty remarkable and inspiring couple of weeks, really.
I'm fascinated because the chapters in the book talk about lots of very different types of music, as I mentioned. Is that fairly representative of your musical tastes?
No, in some, I mean, I always knew that you were going to have to listen to music that I didn't like, or I thought I wouldn't like, you know what I mean? Like, I didn't want to just basically have a book about all the music. I mean, some of it is my music. I love, you know, like the American chapter on souls and blues and jazz and the civil rights struggle, or a lot of the stuff coming out of South Africa, like Miriam McCabe and Hugh Masekela, all of that stuff. And on the British stuff is obviously very, you know, it talks about rock against racism and punk and all those things. So there was lots of it that I did love. But, you know, I wasn't a massive techno fan for Ukraine. I didn't know much about Bossa Nova in Brazil and stuff. But actually, when you go and listen to music in the places where it's created, I think it sometimes feels a bit different. When you speak to the people that are really passionate about creating it or what it means to them, it's pretty hard not to fall in love with it, you know? I mean, there was the odd track that someone would say, you know, listen to this, it's really important, and it was dreadful. But broadly speaking, you know, if someone's really passionate and they're telling you why and you know the story behind it, it's pretty hard not to fall in love with it, I think.
One thing, and apologies, this might be in a part of the book I haven't read, but one thing I find quite fascinating is that there are, thankfully not much, but there are, you know, far right techno groups and, you know, fascist people making techno music, which I find absolutely, I mean, abhorrent, obviously, but also kind of totally illogical if you see where techno music comes from. What do you think about that? Again, apologies if that does come up in the book.
No, it's a really good point, right? Yeah, no, I mean, I agree about techno. I mean, go to Detroit, guys. But like, yeah, I mean, unfortunately, one of the things the book talks about is like, music has this remarkable power. It has this remarkable power, and it essentially opens up a human impulse. You know, we're the only animals that match our movements to the beat and stuff, and that makes it extremely powerful. It's how we find love. It's how we find sex. It's how some people commune with God, and also in the book it talks about this, the way that it has a universal impulse to freedom, right? But there's no doubt that these things can be used for negative stuff as well. I mean, fascist movements in the far right have always used music as a way. The same thing that stirs people to resist, you know, that makes people feel that they can change the world for good, has also been used always. Music can be used for changing the world for bad. I mean, you only have to go back to music in the Third Reich, for example, or the way that it was used in by dictatorships and regimes, or, you know, the way that the Soviet Union used certain forms of music as well. And right up today, as you say, whether or not it's like fascist techno or synth wave or like fash wave in the synth pop scene, or, you know, obviously heavy metal and dark metal's always had some problems with those things as well. I think it's testament, it's that point, which is music is really powerful. And this book, I guess, is arguing that there are people out there using it for bad things, but it's really important to show that it can be used for really positive things as well.
Do you come to any kind of reflection or conclusion in your book on why we're living in a era now where fascism is heavily on the rise all over the world?
Yeah, I mean, I talk about it a little bit in this book. I talk about it a lot more in, I wrote a book a few years ago called Drums in the Distance, which is about the rise of the global far right. And it talks about why is this thing is happening simultaneously in so many different parts of the world. And the big, I mean, obviously there's huge differences between Bolsonaro in Brazil and Trump in America and the European, you can go all those different histories and different cultures and stuff. But one of the commonalities is for so many people around the world, the current system is not meeting the material needs of their lives. You know, the things that people are angry and looking for something different, they want change. And what the far right do very well is they offer really simplistic answers to really complex questions. They turn around and say, your life's not where it should be. Jobs, houses, schools, hospitals, etc., are not as they should be. Here's someone to blame. It's these people's fault. They make it really, really simple. And that's a really powerful argument that is winning in large parts of the world right now. And part of the reason I guess I wanted to write Rebel Sounds was there's lots of people that have fought these wars before for us, you know. There's lots of people that fought these dictatorships, that fought oppression, racism, misogyny, homophobia. And one of the ways they did it was music. And I was thinking, so part of the book is about saying, what can we learn from these people to kind of use in the battles that we've got going on right now?
I mean, famously, you mentioned before Rock Against Racism in the UK, which was sort of late 70s, in response, again, to far right. And also, I believe, to the sort of the awful things Eric Clapton said. You obviously work for Hope Not Hate. How does that organisation use music?
So it's funny, actually. Like I originally, when I started thinking about the book, I was thinking, oh, this will be very different to my day job. But actually, looking back on it, like part of my job at Hope Not Hate for many years was, say, going undercover in far-right groups around the world. And I started to look back on it and think, like, every time I'd go in to do something, I would listen to certain records just kind of get ready for it. Or afterwards, to decompress, I'd listen to certain records. I realized that some of our funding, you know, we have gigs, whether or not it's Billy Bragg or Pete Doherty from the Libertines is doing a concert for us soon. So we'd raise money using music. When we'd have events, there'd be music the whole time. And so I started to realize that actually music had always kind of been there in the work I did at Hope Not Hate. I just hadn't really thought of it. And all those things about saying music makes you think you can carry on when you know, it doesn't, music doesn't change the world, but people change the world, but it makes you feel like you can change the world. And I realized that music was very important for that throughout my kind of life at Hope Not Hate as well.
Is going undercover into far-right organizations as dangerous as we imagine from watching movies?
It's a mixture, right? We try to make it as undangerous as possible. You know, I mean, I spent times with like an armed militia group in Alabama for a while in the run-up to the Trump election and did some stuff with the Ku Klux Klan and European fascist groups around Europe and stuff. I mean, thankfully, most of the time, it's kind of horrible racists in duffer coats in pub back rooms. I mean, some of it, like the militia groups in Alabama, obviously there was a danger to it, yeah. But
because they've got ammunition.
Because they've got automatic rifles, yeah.
And they can all of a sudden, yeah, all right.
But we do it for a specific reason, right? And one of the things is, you know, the far right lie. You know, they have a front of house where they say, we're not racist, we're not this, we're not that, we're here just to make people's lives better. It's only when you're kind of sat there and they don't think that someone's listening, or they don't see a camera, that you can actually hear what they're planning, what they believe that they're actually wanting to do, you know. And also, how is it they're organized, etc. And so it's a part of what Hope Not Hate does, is to try and make sure we're in the room when they think no one's listening.
I don't know about you, but I mean, you talk about hearing music in those circumstances. If I heard a song I loved being listened to in those circumstances, which could happen, I don't know what they listen to, but I'm sure, you know, it includes stuff I like. I don't think I could. I don't know if I could listen to it again.
Look, there's no doubt. I mean, actually, luckily, to be fair, a lot of the far right, I mean, it wouldn't surprise you. I mean, I think they've got a pretty terrible music tape. And part of that is because, you know, for large sections, not all of it, but for large sections of the far right, you know, they reject any black influences the way they would talk about it. And, you know, you can count on one hand the amount of good music that doesn't have some black influence in there, if at all, right? So most of the music that they liked is dreadful. And the stuff that they were really into, like the synth wave stuff in the alt-right, or the kind of dark heavy metal stuff. I hate it already. So that was all right. But yeah, I mean, of course, you know, there were certain problems. You know, there's certain far right movements over the years that have liked reggae music or that they've liked ska music and those sorts of things. So it is difficult. But luckily, as I say, mainly they talk about horrible politics rather than talking about decent records. So it hasn't happened too often.
But that's something I've always found fascinating about the relationship between sort of British skinheads, like National Front skinheads, who their playlist is basically two-tone records, ska music, all the music from Jamaica. They love it. They're like the biggest consumers. And I could never understand. It's like, hang on a minute. You're all about this, you know, kick the blacks out, you know, no more black people in UK. They're taking our jobs. But you're listening to the music made by black people. It just never, and even the skinheads in Spain who would mimic the British skinheads, again, into ska music, into stuff, you know, wearing the Lonsdale jackets and stuff.
It's almost like they don't have a clue what they're talking about.
I know. And this is England, the film, the film that tackled all that kind of portrayed it a little bit, but I could still not, it's like, someone please explain to me. And I don't know, you've had first experience, I imagine, by dealing with people who might be in those groups. Can you explain, like, how that has been, you know, how Jamaican music has been such a strong part of the skinhead identity?
Yeah, so it's funny. I say funny is probably not the right word, right? But I launched the book Rebel Sounds at a Waterstones in central London on Thursday, and the leader of the National Front Now turned up at the event. And like, you know, we tried to get rid of him for a bit, but actually it was kind of proved the point in one sense that he had to sit there and listen to these records, had to listen to, you know, Nina Simone, you know, The King of Love is Dead, and, you know, Glad to Be Gay by Tom Robinson and stuff. But there has always been, as you say, this kind of weird thing. Now, for some of those people, it's that they were involved in the skinhead subculture. And part of that was obviously the fashion. It was and it was the music. It was the kind of that two-tony stuff, or it was the ska. And then the politics came later, and so they were already into that scene. Other people, it was kind of like, we don't mind the music. It's just that as long as they're not here.
Yeah.
Otherwise they would justify, you know, we like Jamaican music, but why do they have to live in London? And also, but other bits of it is that there was just a hypocrisy there, right? Which is, you know, one of the things you really learn when you look at the far right is, as awful as it sounds, it's easy to think of them as like monsters. They're not like us. You know, we're good people. They're monsters out there. But actually you realize that they're normal people that just have really horrible views. Yeah. And that's scary in one sense, because that means they can be your neighbor. They can be in your workplace and all those sorts of things. Hmm. And so they can have this politics and then they have another life. They've got a family and they're into sport and they're into music and all these sorts of things. It's not always, except for the most extreme ones, it's not necessarily all encompassing where they'll say, okay, I won't listen to black music because I'm racist.
Hmm. Accompanying the book is a quote from Billy Bragg, in which he talks about empathy being the currency of all music, which seemed like a very, very interesting quote. What do you think about that, music and empathy?
I think he was absolutely spot on, actually. I mean, I interviewed Billy in the book, and he was the one, because I mean, basically, when I set out to start the book, for me, it was like, how does music change the world? That was almost going to be the title when I first started it years ago. And I asked every musician I went around the world to meet, you know, Femi Kuti in Nigeria, you know, I went everywhere I'd go, I'd say, can music change the world? And Billy Bragg, rather surprisingly, said, no, it can't. And I was like, well, that's a bit inconvenient. I said, explain it. And basically he said, music doesn't change the world, but what it does is it makes people feel they can change the world through empathy. When they stand in a room together, you know, on that Friday night, and they listen to that thing and they have that collective experience, they realize that they're not alone. They might be angry about something, and that music makes them realize that the musician that's making it is also angry about it, and the people that have bought the records are angry about it, and the people you watch the gig with are angry about it. And that sense of empathy where you turn around and actually say, I'm not alone in this, makes you think, actually, maybe we can do something about it. And it kind of flipped the book on the head, really, in one sense, because he's absolutely right. It's not the record itself that changes anything. It's the people that listen to those records, or it's the way that that record makes people feel. And if it makes people feel, that turns around and says, yes, I have this empathetic understanding of someone's pain or someone's anger or someone's struggle, makes you think, well, I'm going to show solidarity to that struggle. I'm going to engage in it myself. And so it is absolutely right. It's not the music itself. It's the people that consume the music and what it does to the people that consume it.
I wanted to end with a question that sort of maybe seems slightly open, but kind of does interest me, which is like you have spent many years investigating far-right organizations, fascist organizations, which, you know, is very obviously very depressing.
It's not bottling honey, is it?
No. But like, again, from what I've read in the book, you know, there is music as a power of resistance. This is happening all over the world, you know, despite all the awful events that are happening in Ukraine. You do see, you know, real solidarity. You see this empathy. Do you still keep some optimism about the sense of what, even after all you've seen, all the terrible, terrible things you've seen?
Massively, massively so, right? And it's because, you know, we've fought these battles before and we've won them, right, through history, and we'll win them again, right? And the good news is that as horrible as things can be, certainly now there's a lot going on. You know, in Britain we've just had the worst period of far-right violence probably in the post-war period in that set of riots, horrifying scenes. And it is easy to get down and feel hopeless, right? But the good news is that these groups remain a minority everywhere. You know, I mean, even when they're sometimes in power in governments, they don't have over 50% of the population, or very rarely. So the only way we lose these battles is if we don't stand up and fight them. The majority of people agree with people like ourselves that don't want this sort of politics and don't want that sort of hatred. So the uplifting bit of this is that we only lose to these people if we decide not to stand up to them. And I find that pretty empowering. And the book, that's what I loved so much about doing this research in the book, was finding these people, in some senses, that gave huge amounts of their life to it, but that found these ways that turned around and said, no, I'm not going to let this pass. I am going to stand up. I am going to do that. You know, and they made records that inspired other people to do the same thing. And so I feel, you know, it's easy to get really down. Of course it is. But I feel really hopeful because, as I say, this book tells stories over 100-year period, ranging from Ireland to Ukraine, that show how people have won in the past. And hopefully there's a few little tools and tricks and ideas in there. You know, when people are angry now, don't just go on a campaign, although do it. Don't just vote, although do it. Pick up a guitar or a drum or a set of decks, or pick up a record. And if you can't find that song, go and write one, you know? So I feel pretty inspired about it. And I think that I feel pretty hopeful as well.
Joe Marhol, Dr. Joe Marhol, to give you your full name. Thank you so much. The book, Rebel Sounds, Music as Resistance, is out now. It's been out since Thursday. I was just looking on, you certainly can buy it in Spain. I was looking on the very popular bookselling website. I'm sure you can find it other places as well. But you definitely can find it in Spain. And you can just get a Kindle. Well, no, you can buy the hardback or the Kindle or whatever. And I thoroughly recommend it. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you, Joe.
Thanks for having me.